content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll share with you information from various medical sources. From the Dementia Alliance of North Carolina. Common dementias explained. Overview. Dementia can be caused by a number of different conditions. It is a symptom of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, frontotemporal dementia, or corticobasal degeneration. The term dementia describes a progressive degenerative decline in cognitive function that gradually impairs memory and the ability to learn, reason, make judgments, communicate, and carry out daily activities. While it often includes memory loss by itself does not mean that a person has dementia. Dementia affects more than 50 million people worldwide. Alzheimer's dementia, or AD. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive degenerative brain disease that slowly erodes memory and thinking skills, and eventually even the ability to carry out simple tasks. It is the most common cause of dementia. Alzheimer's may occur in combination with vascular dementia or other dementias. Frontotemporal dementia, FTD. Frontotemporal dementia is a group of related conditions resulting from the progressive degeneration of the temporal and frontal lobes of the brain. These areas of the brain play a significant role in decision-making, behavioral control, emotion, and language. Common forms of FTD. Primary progressive aphasia is caused by degeneration in the areas of the brain that control speech and language. This type of aphasia begins gradually with speech and or language symptoms that will vary depending on the brain areas affected by the disease. Progressive supranuclear palsy, a degenerative disease of the brain leading to difficulties with walking and balance, problems with eye movements, changes in behavior, difficulty with speech and swallowing, and dementia. Corticobasal degeneration, a progressive neurological disorder that affects nerve cells that control walking, balance, mobility, vision, speech, and swallowing. Behavioral variant FTD involves changes in personality, behavior, judgment. Behavior and poor judgment go unnoticed by the individual. Inappropriate impulsive behaviors are common, along with apathy and loss of initiative. Memory generally is not affected. Lewy body dementias. That's spelled L-E-W-Y. Lewy body dementias include dementia with Lewy bodies, DLB, and Parkinson's disease with dementia, PDD, and are second most frequent cause of dementia in elderly adults. Common symptoms include problems with movement, visual hallucinations, and fluctuations in thinking skills or attention. Mild cognitive impairment. In contrast to Alzheimer's, where other cognitive skills are affected, mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, is defined by deficits in memory that do not significantly impact daily function. Memory problems may be minimal to mild and hardly noticeable to the individual. Vascular dementia. Vascular dementia is a subtly progressive worsening of memory and other cognitive functions due to chronic reduced blood flow in the brain, eventually resulting in dementia. Clinically, patients with vascular dementia may look very similar to patients with Alzheimer's, and the two diseases are very difficult to distinguish from each other. Vascular dementia may occur in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, what everybody needs to know. What is dementia? Dementia is a nonspecific term used to describe a person having changes in the brain function that interfere with the ability to function and do everyday activities. The person with dementia has problems in multiple areas of brain function. These problems can include memory, language, impulse control, ability to do things for self, personality, understanding of time, etc. Common types of dementia include Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontal temporal dementia, and mixed dementia, more than one type of dementia occurring in the same brain. Different types of dementia impact the brain in different ways, have different symptoms, cause changes in different abilities, in different orders, and at different rates. What is Alzheimer's disease? Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia. It is a progressive and terminal disease. The changes typically occur slowly over months and years, not hours and days. If the person has a sudden change in health status, living situation, or caregiver system, for example, death of a spouse, he or she may appear to change quickly. The brain has actually been changing slowly, but since the person was in a routine, the person's abilities weren't being challenged, and he or she was relying on old patterns and memories to function. The pattern and progression of the disease is predictable, but the experience is individual, and ultimately, the person's entire life is affected by Alzheimer's disease. What are the early signs? Early signs might include memory loss of recent events and information, confusion about place and time, familiar tasks become challenging, trouble finding words, finishing thoughts and sentences, following directions, decreased reasoning ability and altered judgment, changes in mood and personality, frequent mood swings, disinterest or withdrawal, suspicion, difficulty with complex mental tasks, planning, problem solving. How is dementia different from aging and forgetfulness? Aging happens to everyone. Dementia is always a disease. It doesn't happen to everyone. With forgetfulness, new information can be stored. It may take more effort or practice, but new information can stick. With dementia, new information cannot be predictably retained. Forgetful people can use reminders, calendars, lists, and be able to do. With most dementias, these prompts cannot help after the earliest stages. Being forgetful makes an independent life difficult. Having dementia makes independent life impossible. What is normal aging, quote unquote? Normal aging includes being more forgetful, taking longer to learn new information, requiring more patience to learn new skills or technologies. You can do it. Just have to try harder than you used to. Having more trouble recalling people's names more than you used to have. Knowing the word you want but hesitating, eventually finding the word more often than you used to. Diagnosis makes a difference. Early diagnosis is important and accurate diagnosis is critical. Why? Because early treatment is more effective than waiting. Early and accurate diagnosis allows for better planning and opportunity to include the person with dementia in the process. Planning makes a difference in options the person may have as the disease leads to changes in abilities and needs. How is Alzheimer's disease diagnosed? Diagnosis is complicated and includes gathering a lot of information, including history of the changes, health history, medication review, physical exam, especially focusing on neurological and cardiovascular systems, laboratory studies, imaging, study of the brain, MRI, CT, or PET scans, cognitive assessment, what's working well and what's not working well, the emotional assessment, and finally, other tests such as ECG, EEG, etc., as indicated. From the Harvard Health Letter, ask the doctor, does a virus cause Alzheimer's? I know that some viruses live permanently inside us, but only make trouble now and then. I even heard recently that they might be a cause of Alzheimer's disease. Why do they sometimes cause disease, and can we keep that from happening? Answer. We live all of our lives with various microorganisms on us and inside us. One example is the herpes family of viruses. Out of more than 100 herpes viruses, there are 9 that infect humans. Once we get infected with these viruses, usually early in life, they remain with us asleep inside some of our cells, but periodically they wake up or reactivate, start producing multiple copies of themselves and infect other cells. That's what's happening when the cold sore suddenly forms on your lip. When the viruses infect cells, they can damage those cells. Most of the time, the immune system moves in to minimize the damage and allow healing to occur. Sometimes, however, the immune attack against the viruses causes collateral damage. It injures the tissue. It is trying to heal. My uncle used to say, the human body is a brilliantly engineered machine, but it ain't perfect. He suffered from kidney stones. As for Alzheimer's disease, studies published in July 2018 suggest that some cases of Alzheimer's and some other types of dementia might be triggered by infection of brain cells with viruses, primarily the herpes viruses, especially human herpes virus 6A. We know that several herpes viruses live quietly inside cells in our brain. The recent research found that when these herpes viruses reactivate and start to multiply, the immune system in the brain goes into protective mode. It produces a chemical called beta amyloid that interferes with the ability of the viruses to infect other brain cells. That's the good news. Unfortunately, beta amyloid itself damages the brain. Indeed, plaques of beta amyloid are a characteristic finding in the brains of people with Alzheimer's and some other kinds of dementia. Another recent study involving over 40,000 people, followed for many years, reported that people who at some point developed shingles caused by herpes virus or cold sores or genital ulcers caused by two other herpes viruses were found to have higher risk of developing dementia later in life. More astonishing, when those who had been treated with antiviral drugs were compared with those not treated, the former group was 90% less likely to subsequently develop dementia. Many more studies need to be done before the possible role of herpes viruses in Alzheimer's or the possible protective role of antiviral drugs can be considered proven. For now, the message is this. While our body does a good job of protecting us against foreign microbes, sometimes the body's response does more harm than good. As we learn more, we'll be able to reduce that harm. Take that, muscle cramps. Here are the best ways to stop painful cramps and prevent them from returning. A muscle cramp always feels like a surprise. The involuntary contraction strikes without warning, whether it's a Charlie horse in the middle of the night or a back spasm as you reach for an everyday object. That just gently stretch it to your tolerance. That helps to relax the muscle and relieve the uncontrolled contraction, says Madhuri Kale, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. What causes cramps? Exercising without properly warming up the muscles can lead to cramps. Cramps also can occur when a muscle is not able to relax properly, such as from a deficiency of magnesium or potassium in your diet, or when it becomes irritated by a buildup of lactic acid, which can happen if you don't rest your muscle after it has exercised a lot. Dehydration can worsen both of these problems. Kale says older adults often don't drink enough water at night because they want to avoid having to go to the bathroom, and they end up dehydrated. Reduced blood flow to the muscles also can cause cramps. This can occur from narrowing of the arteries to your legs caused by atherosclerosis. It can even happen for stranger reasons. Some people say they get cramps at night if their feet stick out from under the blankets. Being cold can constrict the blood vessels, Kale says. Misfiring nerves that get confused because of neurological conditions such as Parkinson's disease, neuropathy or spine problems that compress nerves in the low back can cause cramps as well. Even common foot problems, such as flat arches, can do it. Finally, Kale says cramps sometimes result from certain medications like diuretics that can cause both dehydration and mineral imbalances. Statin drugs, on the other hand, can cause constant muscle aches, but they rarely trigger cramps. Relief for cramps. Learn some stretches that provide rapid relief when cramps come. Kale's shortcut for nighttime leg cramps in the calf: sit up in bed, loop the blanket around your foot, and gently pull your toes toward you while you keep the knees straight, she suggests. Alternatively, for cramps in the front of the lower leg, just stand up at the side of the bed and put your weight on your toes and lift your heels. This gently stretches the cramped muscle. For back cramps, Kale recommends the child's pose, yoga posture. For hamstring cramps in the back of the thigh, sit on the floor with your leg extended in front of you, slide your hands down your legs until you feel a burning sensation in the cramped muscle. Hold for 30 seconds, then slowly return to a sitting position. After you've stretched the muscle, Kel recommends putting a heating pad on the area to promote blood flow and then gently massage the muscle. Tips to prevent cramps. Kale suggests staying hydrated throughout the day, eating foods rich in magnesium, especially leafy greens, and potassium, bananas, black beans, wearing warm socks at night if you have leg cramps, and keeping your muscles strong and flexible with regular exercises. Quinine tablets used to be recommended but aren't anymore unless cramps are disabling. They can have some bad side effects and interactions with other medications, Kale says. And one more point. Cramps are extremely painful, but they're not a sign of serious illness, says Kale. Stretch the muscle and resume your activity once the cramp goes away. Should you try the keto, K-E-T-O, diet? It's advertised as a weight loss wonder, but this eating plan is actually a medical diet that comes with serious risks. In the world of weight loss diets, low-carbohydrate, high-protein eating plans often grab attention. The Paleo, South Beach, and Atkins diets all fit into that category. They are sometimes referred to as ketogenic or keto diets. But a true ketogenic diet is different. Unlike other low-carb diets, which focus on protein, a keto plan centers on fat, which supplies as much as 90% of daily calories, and it's not the type of diet to try as an experiment. The keto diet is primarily used to help reduce the frequency of epileptic seizures in children. While it also has been tried for weight loss, only short-term results have been studied, and the results have been mixed. We don't know if it works in the long term, nor whether it's safe, warns registered dietitian Kathy McManus, who is the director of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. How does it work? The keto diet aims to force your body into using a different type of fuel. Instead of relying on sugar or glucose that comes from carbohydrates such as grains, legumes, vegetables, and fruits, the keto diet relies on ketone bodies, a type of fuel that the liver produces from stored fat. Burning fat seems like an ideal way to lose pounds, but getting the liver to make ketone bodies is tricky. It requires that you deprive yourself of carbohydrates fewer than 20 to 50 grams of carbs per day. Keep in mind that a medium-sized banana has about 27 grams of carbs. It typically takes a few days to reach a state of ketosis. Eating too much protein can interfere with ketosis. What do you eat? Because the keto diet has such a high fat requirement, followers must eat fat at each meal. In a daily 2,000-calorie diet, that might look like 165 grams of fat, 40 grams of carbs, and 75 grams of protein. However, the exact ratio depends on your particular needs. Some healthy unsaturated fats are allowed in the keto diet, like nuts, or almonds, walnuts, seeds, avocados, tofu, and olive oil. But saturated fats from oils, palm and coconut, lard, butter, and cocoa butter are encouraged in high amounts. Protein is part of the keto diet, but it doesn't typically discriminate between lean protein foods and protein sources high in saturated fats such as beef, pork, and bacon. What about fruits and vegetables? All fruits are rich in carbs, but you can have certain fruits, usually berries, in small portions. Vegetables, also rich in carbs, are restricted to leafy greens such as kale, Swiss chard, and spinach, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, bell peppers, onions, garlic, mushrooms, cucumbers, celery, and summer squashes. A cup of chopped broccoli has about 6 carbs. Keto risks. A ketogenic diet has numerous risks. Top of the list, it's high in saturated fat. McManus recommends that you keep your saturated fats to no more than 7% of your daily calories because of the link to heart disease. And indeed, the keto diet is associated with an increase in bad LDL cholesterol, which is also linked to heart disease. Other potential keto risks include these. Nutrient deficiency. If you're not eating a wide variety of vegetables, fruits, and grains, you may be at risk for deficiencies in micronutrients, including selenium, magnesium, phosphorus, and vitamins B and C. Liver problems. With so much fat to metabolize, The diet could make any existing liver conditions worse. Kidney problems. The kidneys help metabolize protein, and McManus says the keto diet may overload them. The current recommended intake for protein averages 46 grams per day for women and 56 grams for men. Constipation. The keto diet is low in fibrous foods like grains and legumes. Fuzzy thinking and mood swings. The brain needs sugar from healthy carbohydrates to function. Low-carb diets may cause confusion and irritability. Those risks add up, so make sure that you talk to a doctor and a registered dietitian before ever attempting a ketogenic diet. What about the other diets? The popular low-carb diets such as Atkins or Paleo modify a true keto diet, but they come with the same risks if you overdo it on fats and proteins and lay off the carbs. So why do people follow the diets? They're everywhere, and people hear anecdotally that they work. Theories about short-term low-carb diet successes include lower appetite because fat burns slower than carbs, but again, we don't know about the long-term, she says, and eating a restrictive diet, no matter what the plan, is difficult to sustain. Once you resume a normal diet, the weight will likely remain, says McManus. Tips for success when your kids are on your health care team. Be upfront about your needs and set your own ground rules. Allowing your kids to be involved in your health care can have many benefits. The arrangement provides advocates who can help you follow your treatment plan, talk to your doctors, and maybe even make appointments and take you to them. As an added bonus, you get to spend more time with your adult children. But the arrangement isn't always easy. There's a tendency for roles to reverse. The child becomes the parent may not be comfortable with that, or the parent doesn't want to burden the child and lets health issues go until they're too far gone, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard Affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Consider the following tips to navigate the relationship. Set ground rules early. Talk openly with your adult child about your expectations, including these. Time commitment. Be frank about how much help you need and what kind of time that might involve. Do you need someone to take you to the doctor every few months or to come by every day to help with medications? The biggest burden I see is when kids have to run over to the parents' house frequently and work at the same time, Dr. Salomon says. Decisions. Determine in advance how much input you want your adult child to have in your treatment plan, especially if you reach a point where you're unable to make decisions. Accountability. Kids can get very bossy and accusatory, says Mom, and say Mom's not drinking enough water or exercising enough, Dr. Salomon says. Let your child know early on that you expect him or her to be patient and respectful of how you follow your treatment plan. Bring them to the fold. You don't have to tell your kids everything about your health, but the more help you need, the more you'll have to share. If you don't feel comfortable describing your health issues, have your doctor do it. One of the most important pieces of information to provide is a current list of your medications that includes drug names, doses, and times when you take them. Work with your doctor. Tell your doctor that you're adding your adult child to the health care team. Explain how much information is okay to share with your child and whether you want him or her present in the exam room. We can always do half an appointment without the adult child there and then bring in the child for an update, Dr. Salomon says. If your adult child is unable to go to an appointment with you, ask your doctor if it's okay to put him or her on a speakerphone during the visit. I do that quite a bit, Salomon says. But a lot of kids let the parent come to the office alone and want the doctor to call after the visit and tell them what happened. There's just not time for that unless there's a devastating illness. But overall, Dr. Salomon says it's very helpful to work with a parent and child team. The adult child acts as a fact checker and another set of eyes and ears, she says. It's most successful when it's done with love and respect. Your healthcare proxy. Your healthcare proxy or surrogate is a legal representative you name in a healthcare proxy form or as part of a larger advance directive document to make decisions for you. In most states, the proxy status goes into effect only when a doctor determines you lack the capacity to make decisions, such as during temporary or permanent illness or surgery. In some states, such as California and Florida, you can stipulate that your proxy can make health care decisions for you, even if you're still capable. If a friend or adult child who is not your legal health care proxy joins you for a doctor appointment, your doctor may ask you to sign a form allowing him or her to provide your companion with information. However, it's not legally necessary. What's most important is that your loved one knows what your wishes are in the event of illness or emergency. You must discuss this in advance because your health can change in a split second. For more information, check out the Harvard Special Health Report Advanced Care Planning, www.health.harvard.edu/LW. Challenge to your mind, no matter what your age. An observational study published online May 30th, 2018 by JAMA Psychiatry, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association, Psychiatry found that engaging in intellectually stimulating activities even later in life may lower the odds of dementia. Researchers followed over 15,000 Chinese men and women in their 70s for 7 years with annual assessments of health and lifestyle habits, including a variety of leisure activities. The odds of being diagnosed with dementia during the study period were 29% lower in people who challenged their brains daily with such activities as playing board games, reading, and even betting on horse racing. In contrast, less mentally demanding recreational activities like watching TV or shopping or social activities like going to tea with friends did not appear to be associated with a lower risk of dementia. Other studies have found similar evidence, but this one made a special effort to adjust for factors like better overall health that might otherwise account for the association between brain exercise and dementia. Americans aren't meeting exercise goals. Not getting enough exercise? You're not alone, suggests a report published online June 28, 2018, by the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. Researchers looked at health survey information collected from all 50 states and the District of Columbia from 2010 to 15. The results among adults ages 18 to 64 years old, just 27% of men and 19% of women met the guidelines for both aerobic and muscle strengthening activities. The numbers were a little higher for men and women who worked and lower if they were unemployed. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.